Chapter 25. The news of the Battle of Svold spread quickly. Even while the bishop had been telling it to Theobrand, the bishop's men were telling it to Theobrand's house servants, and the survivors of the battle were telling it to whoever had picked them out of the water. The victors boasted of it, their skalds sang of it, and their swords carved it on any Christian who refused to believe that God had let it happen. Soon there was only one place where it was not known. That was on the ship, which was bringing the Sea King and his men back to Iceland. They alone, who never had accepted Olaf's rule, thought he still ruled. As they put out from Wineland, it was the rowers who, facing the shore as they bent to the oars, were the last to see what they were leaving. The Sea King, in his high seat in the stern, saw only water and horizon. He had, however, no reason to look back. What concerned him lay ahead, both in space and time. He had a strange amount of courage for a man whose gods had just died. There was very little left to him by which many live. No more mystery, no more illusion, only reality and the sudden, chilling need to face it. Perhaps he would have ended his life with his era had he not possessed an unusual safeguard against that kind of despair. This was the ancient prophecy in which his gods had predicted their own end. For a religion which never preached humility, that was very humble. It was also very helpful. Through warning him that the new world would one day surely slay the old, he was saved from being under an empty sky. In time, a soul as practical as his might even accept the strange conquering god. For the moment, he was unable to consider what he must do next, with no allies but other men, as had been done before there were gods of any kind. There was comfort in still having tasks. The tiller felt very real to his touch, and it was he and the crew, and nothing else, who were holding the ship to its course. And besides steering, there were two things which must be done, no matter who or what dwelt above the clouds. He must rescue his son and kill Tyrker. Revenge in particular would be a grateful duty. There was no longer any reason to hold back from it. At last he had his grievance to justify the trick that had stolen Tyrker's freedom. He could look his thrall in the face now, without flinching, and plan how to kill him. Custom demanded that a murderer be slain by the nearest in kinship to the dead, surely by himself, who was in truth her husband. In Iceland, the law said that murder could be paid for in gold, it being held that gold and blood were equal. But what gold could a thrall have, and what vast amounts of it there would need to be to pay for such blood as hers? By all the reckoning he knew, a life must pay here for a life. These two aims, of rescue and revenge, served him in place of his old beliefs as a source of fresh energy. They gave him an almost gleeful abandon, not unlike that he'd felt as a boy, when he only played at being rescuer or avenger. He was able to set his men an example of endurance in the fight against the westward current that had been their friend. His voice was the loudest in their songs. He stayed awake longer and strove harder than any, and evoked tremendous efforts with tales of the famous deeds of old times. Through one of these tales, he made certain that he was right in suspecting Tyrker of the murder, not merely seeking a victim on whom to vent the bitterness of his loss. It was the story of the five sons of Ragnar Lothbrok, and the revenge they took on their father's slayer. Although the revenge was for the murder of a father instead of a wife, by sons instead of by a husband, upon an English king instead of upon a Turkish thrall, It was revenge nonetheless and took many patient years to achieve, requiring the sons, among other tasks, to gain their victims' trust by founding the city of London. Their revenge at last was so complete that all five were satisfied. Their father had been slain for possession of a handsomely carved throne chair, so now they bound their captive and made him judge a wood-carving contest among them. The one he declared the winner carved the blood eagle on his back. The Sea King told this with his gaze fixed throughout upon Tyrker to see whether he would turn pale or his forehead begin to sweat, never looking away from him for so much as a single word. When he had finished, the pallor and sweat were both seen, and Tyrker knew it. And though he explained that they were due to the excitement of the story and the vivid way it was told, his master knew the real cause, and Tyrker grew nervous, wondering whether he did. It was the first time the advantage of their positions had been reversed. The whole of Tyrker's scheme to deliver them all into Olaf's hands did not suggest itself. The deepest plot a thrall's mind seemed capable of forming was for an attempt on his master's life. So the Sea King slept with his hand on a dagger, and then only at such times as he was sure Tyrker was already asleep. He could not kill Tyrker aboard ship. That was not through fear of anything his men might say or think. They would accept anything their leader did. It was because of a promise, which had to be made good. He had told Tyrker he would free him. "I give my word," he had said, "for all of you to witness. It shall be in such time and place as will let all the world know it." He must keep his word, even though he must also kill Tyrker. Both had somehow to be done. The problem did not trouble him. There was even a certain pleasure in thinking of fanciful ways it might be solved, and another pleasure in tormenting Tyrker in the meantime. One morning, when they had been 3 or 4 days at sea, he told the crew he thought they were passing over the very spot where the great father of serpents, Ormungandr, lay on the bottom of the sea. He seized Tyrker by the collar, dragged him to the rail, and made him look into the depths, shouting at him as he did. "Look, see where Thor flung the monster long ago. There he lies, still hoping that men will be sacrificed to him as they once were." Tyrker was frightened, thinking he was about to be just such a sacrifice. Yet he dared not struggle, being unsure how much the Sea King knew, and could not let it be seen that he had a reason to be afraid. His master held him thus for a moment, then released him, roaring with laughter all the while. Soon afterward, the Sea King asked the crew's advice about what he should do to Theobrand if he caught him. "This priest has done me great wrongs," he said. "He has told my son that what I taught him was false, and turned my wife into a Christian under my roof." Then, turning to Tyrker, he said, "You, Tyrker, are, like the priest, a foreigner to Iceland. What revenge can you suggest that he would find most harrowing?" Confused and upset, Tyrker replied uneasily, "A quick death might be the best," and then gave the weak reason that the Avenger might be surprised by his victim's friends if he were too long about it. His companions' faces showed him that he was sounding too much like a thrall again, so he hastily changed his answer. "Revenge itself," he said, "may not be as worth having as we suppose. What does it do, after all, but waste one's own time and effort?" Then he realized that he was sounding too much like a Christian, so he gave a loud laugh and pretended it had been a huge joke to repay the one that had been played on him with Ormungandr. He proposed that when they landed, they should all keep together and make their first undertaking the rescue of Eric and the capture of Theobrand, who could be tortured at their leisure when they were back on the ship, and thus enlivened the voyage back to Wineland. This delighted the crew and restored their enthusiasm. Besides being a reward to their Sea King for all he had done, it was so attractive to them that they would not consider another option. Someone started chanting a bit of doggerel, in which they all joined, and by its rhythm, they were able to row much more easily. The Blood Eagle flaps its wings and flies to the east to kill a priest. Row to the east, row to the priest. Row to the east, row to the priest. To the vulture's feast, row, row. They were in such high spirits that the Sea King did not tell them that the great doom had fallen upon Odin and Thor and their kin. They would find it out for themselves when the time came. Until then, let them keep their glee, since it was getting them to Iceland the faster. He knew what they did not, that they could get revenge and treasure and women and honor and all else they valued, whether they did it in the name of the old gods or the new or none. Those rewards awaited them in Iceland, and they were steering and rowing there through an ocean that was only an ocean, not a giant who was plotting against them. He found a new pleasure and pride in pitting his mind and muscles against something that had none. His men went on singing their song. So did he, with just as much fervor, but he had his own secret words to it. The Blood Eagle flies to shore to settle a score for me, not Thor. It was just at sunset one day that they at last caught sight of Iceland. It was very far away, a mere break in the horizon line, but they had seen it too often to be mistaken. There had been many trips before in which they had returned to it, though they had then been Icelanders coming home, not Winelanders coming to raid. It could not possibly be seen from shore, for their ship was too small and too out at sea. If there were any lookouts, which, they reasoned, there would be if Olaf had not yet arrived, they would be scanning the east for him, not the west, whence no one ever came. Following their time-honored raiding tactics, they waited beyond range of vision until dark, then raised their sail and pulled strongly for shore. If Olaf's fleet were in, it would be in the harbor, so they headed instead for a cove about a mile to the west of it. Every inch of the coast was so familiar to them that the darkness was no hindrance, and they were able to reckon that they would beach their vessel a little after midnight. That would leave them about 5 hours before people would be up and aware, in which time they must do what they had come for. So as not to waste any of it ashore in useless talk, the Sea King now laid down the plan that they would follow when they landed. "The instant we touch ground," he said, speaking softly, for voice can travel a great distance over water, "you are to pull the ship clear, but only so far as will let you push it quickly back, in case there should be need. The 10 of you who pull the oars nearest the stern will stay behind to guard the ship. The rest will come with me. We will remain together, as Tyrker suggested, going from place to place in force, to my house first. Such captives as we take are to be gagged and have their hands bound. And the 6 of you who row closest to the stem have the task of goading them to the ship with your sword points. Of those we do not capture, none are to be left alive to give an alarm, and as we have agreed that we shall be among foes, old feelings need not stand in the way." Then he read them Tyrker's death warrant. He had it ready now, worked out to his liking. "When we reach my house," he said, "I shall redeem a promise. With Theobrand and whoever is with him as witnesses, before we make them slaves or cut their throats, I shall set Tyrker free." He quickly stopped the cheer they were about to give, lest it be heard ashore, and added silently to himself, "And then shall Tyrker die." Such a death would pay for that other in the Wineland forest. The thrall must die bitterly while he was first tasting his freedom and dreaming how to use it. Parker's heart beat high. His master was planning something, but what it was, he did not care. He had duped them all. They would stay together like silly sheep, and he would run ahead of them in the darkness to Theobrand. When they got there, 100 Christian spears would await them in the shadows. To shore they sped, master and thrall scheming to outwit each other, not knowing that Olaf had outwitted them both by drowning in the waters off the coast of Svold. When they landed, the men at once went forward with the plan they had been given. They pulled the ship around, just so far that its stern still floated, and the 10 rear oarsmen stood guard about it. The rest set out along the familiar ways they had never thought to walk again. The darkness was complete, without moon or stars, but their drawn swords were ready for whoever might chance to meet them. The Sea King wondered, as they went toward his house, how Theobrand would act when they caught him, whether as coward or martyr. Would he plead for his life and offer to renounce his faith? He who was so ruthless with other men's faiths? Or would he face them with brave contempt, believing what he believed, sure that he was on the winning side? Tyrker had no trouble slipping away. The others had no reason to suspect he would, when he had his freedom to gain by staying with them. He almost laughed at them. He stood still, letting them walk past him in the darkness. Then he left the path and ran toward the house by another way, so they should not hear his footsteps. He knew the countryside as his master never did. He knew where thralls hid to avoid punishment, and where they kept their stolen bits of gold and silver with which someday to buy their freedom. He knew where a thrall had buried a free man's body, and where he hid the knife he'd killed him with. The rocks and thickets were his secret friends. They knew him and helped him onto his way. As he raced toward Theobrand, his thoughts raced too. His son, his home, his country. He was going to get them all back. They came nearer with each step. When he reached the road outside the gate, he saw that a light was shining out from under the door of the guest hall. Good, they were awake. No need to pull Theobrand out of bed and waste time making him understand. He climbed over the gate and hastened along the path to the door. He was full of his coming triumph. "They're here, all of them," he would say to Theobrand. "Now, man of God, I claim the reward you promised." He raised his hand to the great iron knocker and rapped boldly with it, as befit one who would soon be free. The door did not open immediately, and he fretted with every precious second. While he waited, he wondered why there were no guards. His heart sank with sudden fear that the Winelanders might somehow have got here before him and left no one alive. But then the door opened. As he stepped inside, he did not see anyone and wondered who could have opened the door for him. It seemed to have been done by an invisible hand. He whirled about, thinking this person must be behind him. Still, he saw no one. Then a voice, coming strangely from below him, said, "Tyrker." He looked down and saw Eric. Old habits seized upon him. "Eric," he said, "why are you up so late?" "There was no one to put me to bed." "Where is your mother?" "At my grandfather's house." "Didn't she take you with her?" "Yes, but I came back." "Where are the servants?" "They ran away." "And left you here alone?" "Oh no," said Eric gravely. "They left me with him." He pointed. Tyrker looked and saw for the first time that someone was sitting in a chair in the middle of the great hall. He hurried to him. Tyrker had expected many men. He found only one, and that one was dead. The magnificent decorations, old and new, glittered and gleamed by the light of the fire and the many torches in their stanchions. In the very center of it all, in Red Eric's old high seat with the effigies of Locke on its pillars, sat Theobrand the priest in his blue and scarlet clothes, with the fur cloak about his shoulders and the golden circlet on his forehead. That he had not fallen or slumped was because he was pinned to the chair by the great spear which had hung in the bracket near the outer door. He must have been very drunk, and his slayer very persistent, for the heavy spear to have been forced through that far. As Tyrker looked at him, unable or unwilling to realize what this meant to him, he heard Eric speaking. "I gave him to Odin," said Eric proudly. "You?" asked Tyrker, brought to his senses by horror. "Yes," said Eric, and he seemed to be waiting for praise. Tyrker seized him by his little shoulders and shook him. "Why have you done this?" he cried. "I never harmed you. Why? Why?" Eric did not understand this. "I gave him to Odin," he repeated stoutly. "There is no Odin," Tyrker screamed at him frantically. "Christ has killed him. Only Christ lives. Christ and Olaf. Where is Olaf? Where is the king? He's waiting for me. I must see him." "You can't," Eric answered, and began to cry because this was the first time Tyrker had ever been rough with him. "You know you can't." Tyrker heard the crunching sound of many feet coming up the path from the gate. Running feet. How quickly they'd got here. They must have found that he was missing and hurried after him. They knew. He could never trick them again. Here was his last minute on Earth, unless he could get Christian help. Summoning all the will he had left, he made himself speak gently to Eric. "Why can't I see Olaf?" he asked. "Because Odin has him too," said Eric. "I thought everyone knew that." It was true. Tyrker could see it was by the boy's earnest little face, and his last spark of hope faded. He made an uncertain step forward to bolt the door, but desisted. It swung open and the Sea King came in, his men back of him. All Tyrker wanted now was to make sure he would leave this life, in which everyone had cheated him, and reach a heaven which he hoped would be more honest. "Help!" he shouted, knowing there would be no answer. "Help! The heathen have come back!" Then he faced them all, crossed himself and waited, as the Sea King came toward him with a drawn sword to free him.